You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm Aaron Sagers, and this is Talking Strange.
Hello, spooky nerds, and welcome to Talking Strange, a paranormal pop culture show with the Den of Geek Network, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. I'm your host, journalist, author, researcher of weird things, Aaron Sagers, also appearing as the host of the Netflix series 28 Days Haunted, and you can catch me on the Travel Channel and Discovery Plus show, Paranormal Caught on Camera. Now, before we bring in our guest, John Wright, director of Unwelcome, got a question for you. Do you have a story about a haunted doll or a toy that made life hell? I want to hear about it. The Talking Strange Paranormal Podcast is teaming with Full Moon Features to give away, only 900 of these have been made, to give away a 1-to-1 scale replica Baby Oopsie doll, the demon toy from the movie franchise. And to get this, all you got to do is you email me your true scary story about a haunted toy or haunted doll or cursed doll or demon toy, whatever works for you. Email it to talkingstrange@denofgeek.com and we'll read the winning story on the March 7th episode of Talking Strange. Now on to my guest. Director John Wright, also from Grabbers and Robot Overlords, has a new movie out called Unwelcome. It's based on a story concept by him and an original screenplay by Mark Stay. It stars Hannah John Kamen, who we know from Ant-Man and the Wasp, and also she's going to be in the upcoming MCU movie, The Thunderbolts. And she plays mother-to-be Maya, and Douglas Booth from the Netflix movie The Dirt in Jupiter Ascending plays her husband Jamie. The couple escapes their urban nightmare to the tranquility of rural Ireland, only to hear stories of mysterious beings who live in the gnarled ancient wood at the foot of their new garden. And as warned by their new neighbors, the Irish lore creatures of the Redcaps abound, and they will come when called to help, souls in dire need of rescue. But it's crucial to remember that there's always a dear price to pay for their aid. Actually, about the Red Caps, they really are part of Irish folklore. They're not to be confused with leprechauns. These little people in Irish mythology are, instead of having a pot of gold, they're violent creatures whose caps are red because they're soaked in the blood of victims. And in the movie, they're more akin to playful, mischievous goblins who play pranks on people. If you call out for the Red Caps, they're going to come out and help you, but there is a price to pay for that help. Now, the movie Unwelcome is a creature feature as well as something of a home invasion film. It begins with this couple that's threatened in their London flat only to move to the Irish countryside, and they inherit a home that's been left to them by an aunt who has passed away. And they set about doing renovations on the home as well as interacting with these superstitious townspeople who warn them to set out food nightly for the Red Caps. But there's the other threat, which involves a family of local contractors who are up to no good and resent these English interlopers. Unwelcome is available now on digital in the UK, and it's coming to select theaters in the US on March 10th and available on digital March 14th. Okay, let's go ahead and bring in director John Wright. All right, John Wright, thank you so much, director of Unwelcome, and I appreciate you joining me today. I enjoyed the heck out of this movie, and I was saying to the publicist, Warner Brothers publicist, this is one that I've been kind of tracking for a year now when that initial trailer dropped, yeah. So I'm glad to finally have it in my hands. I've read a little bit about the origins of the story, and I'd like to hear more from you. How did you land on this notion of Red Caps as your monster of choice?
Well, I guess the thing we wanted to talk about was violence. And we were looking at mythological creatures in Ireland and myths and legends and fairy tales and folk tales and thinking, you know, what would fit the theme? And the theme is, you know, violence, really. You know, what are you prepared to do when the chips are down? And we just thought Red Caps captured that and encapsulated that quite nicely, because they're goblins who dip their caps in the blood of their victims. And that's why they're Red Caps. And you thought, well, that's sort of interesting, because you don't do that unless you're into violence. You know, you don't proudly sort of soak your cap in blood unless you enjoyed killing the thing that provided the blood, you know. So that sort of felt like a fit. They didn't sound like very nice goblins. And the thing that appealed to me was, obviously, Ireland is associated with leprechauns, and it felt to me like almost taking the cliche, the stereotype of leprechauns, and doing something very subversive with it. So I quite like that. Like, on the surface, it's about, you know, cute gnomey type characters, but really they're not like that at all.
And you have Irish heritage yourself, right? I believe I read that your grandfather did believe in, was it fairies or?
Yeah. So my grandfather was a farmer, and he lived in the countryside in Ireland, and he claimed that he tried to build a wall on what he called a fairy shee, which is sort of a fairy's magical place, you know. And he tried to build a brick wall, and every he'd build the wall, and then in the morning when he got up, the wall would be knocked down again. And he did it 3 times, and then he realized, okay, this is where the fairies live. And so that was left to grow wild, that bit of his farm. And, you know, he really believed that. He was quite a kind of mischievous, humorous character. So he would tell me tall stories and things like that. But I actually think he did believe this, yeah.
So I'm a bit of a student of folklore, yeah, and strangeness out there, and I, yeah, happen to love it. I've been familiar with the Red Caps for quite a while, and I love that there are the leprechauns, and they're mischievous, but not really outwardly violent. But the Red Caps, their legacy has always been, yeah, nasty little things hanging out in castles, carrying pikes. What were some of the things that you wanted to add to the folkloric personality of these Red Caps, your twist on them?
I mean, I suppose we sort of wanted to make them take a kind of gleeful pleasure in what they do. And they do some really horrible things in the movie, particularly in the final third, they do some very nasty things. And we wanted to make it so that they don't feel guilty. They don't feel apologetic about it. They sort of love it, you know. So they represent that side of our natures as people. You know, we are, whether we like it or not, we are record-breaking, award-winning murderers as a species. You know, we've killed everything on the planet. And we've killed each other in astounding numbers. And so that is in us, you know. And obviously, for a lot of people, like myself, you know, we live in a civilized world, and that side of our natures is, you know, maybe we're in denial of it. Maybe we don't like it. And that's really what the film was about. So the Red Caps in the movie, they love it. And I think there's something really enjoyable about that. I enjoy it anyway. You know, it's the thing I enjoyed about Gremlins, Joe Dante's Gremlins, the sort of the mischievous glee and the pleasure that they took in all of the havoc that they were wreaking. And I suppose they were a bit more, you know, they were more like tricksters, I suppose. But we kind of take that and push it a bit further even.
This, and I will get to the kind of the tone of the film and, yeah, sort of the subtext with a lot of it, but staying with the Red Cap creatures themselves for a moment, when you were telling people seem like everybody, you know, knows what a leprechaun is around the world, but, yeah, did you have to, was this kind of lost to time with a lot of the people that you were kind of explaining the concept to, or did people know what a Red Cap was in Ireland when you were, no. So
no, I mean, a few people did, you know, and they've kind of, you know, they've crept in and out of things. So, for example, they get a mention in Harry Potter somewhere. You know, they're around, you know, and people that are students of this kind of thing like yourself do know about them. But no, not really. They're not a very commonly known myth, you know, and that was part of the fun, was I felt like it gave us quite a lot of freedom to reinvent them and do them the way that we wanted to do them. So we made them into these kind of magical creatures who have a foot in the real world and a foot in the magical world. And so if you went into our particular wood in search of these red caps, you wouldn't be able to find them, you know, they just wouldn't be there. Whereas if you went into that wood and you needed them in your life and you emotionally needed those red caps, you're going to find them, you know. So it's that sort of, you know, we had the freedom to do that kind of thing. Whereas, I mean, whether that's authentic or not to the actual existing legends that are out there, I don't think it is really.
Well, where was, now you filmed during, was it beginning of 2021? I know it was still in peak pandemic time.
Pandemic, yeah. We took a big risk, really. I mean, a lot of the people on our show were very glad to be at work. I mean, I particularly was extremely glad to be out of the house, but we did run the risk of having a shutdown, yeah.
And where did you actually shoot? Where was production?
So the interiors are all shot in England in a place, I guess, quite near Watford, where the Harry Potter movies are shot. We converted an airfield into a sort of pandemic-proof bunker. So everything inside is in England. Everything outside is in Ireland, more or less. Okay. So we went across to Ireland after the pandemic was over, and we shot a whole bunch of exterior stuff as well.
The creepy woods where the red caps exist. Now, was that soundstage or are those actual wooded areas?
It's a bit of both, actually. What did you think when you watched it?
It felt real. I mean, yeah. I looked into some of the production and I didn't see where it was shot. I didn't see that in the notes. Yeah. And it did feel like a tangible wood. And that added to the personality, this mysterious personality of the entire film, and this little village, this little hamlet with these creepy woods surrounding it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we went across in Ireland, we shot in a place called Cong, which is CNOG. Which is where they shot The Quiet Man, the John Wayne movie. And it's a very beautiful, picturesque, almost, you know, cliched Irish village. It's an amazing village, a great place to have a pint of Guinness. But through that town, they have these huge, big logging trucks that drive through, you know, a bit like the big trucks in Pet Sematary, you know. And I like the fact that you could see that there was woods everywhere all around the town, and you could see the evidence of people taking the woods away, you know, and driving these huge big logging trucks through the village. And I thought that kind of grounded it and rooted it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
The woods are a huge part of the film. And I like to think of the film as an adult fairy tale in the old fashioned sense of the word fairy tale, like a Grimm's fairy tale, you know, which to me have an edge of horror to them. If you read the original versions before they were censored by the Victorians. And this is a fairy tale for grown-ups. It's not really appropriate for children, but I think it's got some of the same flavor, you know. And there's a little bit of Hansel and Gretel there when they go into the woods and they find the little house there.
Yeah, and Hansel and Gretel didn't make it out of the house. They didn't defeat the witch. It was the other way around.
It's not very nice what happened to Hansel and Gretel.
This is sort of a two-part question, but
yeah.
For you as a storyteller, why do you think there's an appeal to folk horror and examining these old beliefs through the context of our modern lens?
I think I mean, I'm speaking personally because obviously everyone has their own reasons for making folk horrors, but I feel like a lot of us spend our days with our nose in a screen, you know. And we've built this quite sophisticated zoo for ourselves. You know, we are animals, I believe, but we're apart from nature, and we've actually set ourselves away from nature on purpose. It's almost like we were so traumatized by millennia of being chased by saber-toothed tigers and angry gorillas and I don't know what, that we've decided we're better off in the safety of our little zoo that we've made. And I think, but inside a lot of us, I'd say certainly inside myself, there's a bit of a yearning to be back, back in nature and to be part of nature again. You know, and we sort of miss the woods and find our screens, the life with our screens is a little bit sterile maybe. You know, this is ironic for somebody who's a filmmaker who spent, I literally spent my whole life looking at a screen. But yeah, you know, it's a sort of yearning to rejoin nature, I think. And that's very much what this film's about. It's about going back to the woods, you know, and finding out what your primal self is actually like.
There's something about Irish fairy tales and folklore in particular that has a haunting quality to it. Yeah. And I wanted to get your perspective on it. And it's funny that we're having this conversation because I had recently spoken to Lee Cronin, who is the director of the new Evil Dead movie.
Oh, yeah.
And there's, it's not a heavy influence, but you definitely see these little Celtic nods and Irish nursery rhymes. And it's great because it creeps the hell out of you. So from your perspective, what is it about Irish stories in particular that lend itself to horror?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm that person who left Ireland as a very young kid and went back there every summer and spent my summers there. And it's sort of, I suppose because of that, because I'm that person who doesn't live there, it's quite a romantic place for me, you know, and it has a little bit of magic for me, Ireland. And so, yeah, I probably see it through that lens, but also when you read all the fairy tales, all the old fairy tales, the Irish ones are a bit different. So I suppose a lot of them are different in different ways. You know, Indian ones are quite different, et cetera. But the Irish ones have this sort of slightly whimsical quality. And they also do these magical leaps in the stories where completely bizarre, surreal things happen. And it's just thrown in there as if, yeah, this happened next. But it doesn't necessarily follow norm everyday logic. It follows a sort of dream logic. And that fits to me with the Irish character, which I think they are, not everybody, but I think a lot of Irish people are quite poetic. Mm-hmm. They have that, you know, there's a disproportionate number of poets have come from the Emerald Isle and writers generally, actually. But it's just in the way ordinary people tell stories, sometimes it can be very poetic. So, yeah, I think that flavor is in the movie a little bit. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I think it is.
Well, it's fascinating to me because you've spoken of this sort of the natural world that we've built up these, our own zoos to contain us,
escaping
the natural realm, natural world. And in Ireland, it's not only this wooded area, but it's the origin of these ancient people, the Druids, the Celts, you know, so you have, and there was that magical element to what they were doing. So they were humans, but they weren't the humans that we recognize on a daily basis. They were tapped into that deeper magic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting to look back at, it's interesting to look at times where people had different values to us, you know, and I think a lot of people find that interesting to kind of looking back to the pre-Christian era. And, you know, a lot of that stuff has carried over into what we believe and think today. But yeah, I think it's interesting to go back, way back to, you know, when we were hunter gatherers even, you know, I find that interesting to think about. I think about that a lot as I get older. I think a lot of what we do is driven by urges that were kind of forged when we were hunter-gatherers, you know, and we still behave in the same way in a lot of ways. You know, a lot of the things we desire and a lot of the things that we want are to do were actually more useful and important back then.
Yeah.
Than they are useful to us now. You know, and I'd say violence is one of those things. You know, I think there was a time when our violent urges were probably extremely useful and probably actually wouldn't be the difference between survival and not. And whereas now they're actually probably a bit of a nuisance, you know, they're kind of quite unhelpful. And the more violent people are, the more likely they are to end up in prison or, you know, completely out of society.
Well, this young couple, the protagonists of the film, they're city folk. They're clearly, you know, very well, they come across as sort of this liberal, civilized couple trying to avoid conflict.
Yeah.
And yet the conflict finds them. It's almost in some ways that the more sometimes conflict avoidance leads to more conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think anyone who's managed people, which I have, knows that you can't avoid conflict, you know. And if you try and avoid conflict, it will come and find you. And the worst thing you can do is avoid confrontation, you know. And that would have been my instinct when I was younger, you know, when I was starting out directing, I hated confrontation, and I would, you know, I'm naturally kind of quite an easygoing person. And I would sort of shy away from it, but then you really, all you're doing is making it worse. But you're just kicking the ball down further down the line. It's going to come back twice as strong, you know. So you kind of get to accept confrontation. But I guess what we thought was interesting was this couple who are at the beginning of the movie, you know, like literally in the first frame of the film, if you said, "Are you pacifists?" they would say, "Yes." You know, we don't believe in violence. And we sort of wanted to push them and test that question and say, okay, so you're pacifists. Let's make everything happen to you that could possibly happen to get you to question those values and see what, and see, you know, what your answer is. And I guess with the two characters, we've got two completely different answers, you know, to the question, what are you prepared to do to defend your family? And it all started life because me and my co-writer, Mark Stay, we were kind of laughing at each other, really. We were talking about how we were cowards and we'd say we were pacifists, but really it was a nice way of describing, you know, of covering up the fact that we were cowards and that we couldn't handle ourselves in fights. And when we were around, you know, fights in pubs or whatever, we'd get quite nervous because we wouldn't, you know, we knew we couldn't really handle ourselves if the fight came our way. But then we were also saying, you know, we both got children. I've got a 13-year-old son. And we're saying if our children were threatened, we would actually be violent people. Mm-hmm. And we probably, because we were, not able to throw a punch, we would probably grab a weapon. And the violence that we would get into would probably be way more violent than somebody who was more confident in that scenario. And we'd try and bring the violence to an abrupt and quick end, you know. And so that was what was interesting to us. That was what started off the journey on the movie, really, was we were thinking, okay, well, how can two pacifists be violent? That doesn't, you know, that's a contradiction in terms. It doesn't make sense. It felt like a dramatic question, you know, like let's ask that. Let's get these two characters and let's ask this question to them and see what the answer is. And, you know, we have the protagonist, the hero of the movie, Maya, is heavily pregnant. And, you know, she's about to cross the threshold between being somebody on her own and somebody who's a parent. And so she's going to have to, you know, figure out what she really thinks about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, meanwhile, Douglas Booth's character, yeah. Jamie, there's this violent encounter at the beginning of the movie in London. And then they go out to the countryside, Irish countryside. And he's clearly struggling with his masculinity. I wouldn't call it like a toxic masculinity because it seems like he's trying to struggle with how to be a protector, but also it's a complicated scenario. And I think there would be a tendency with certain films that we've seen in the past to expect him to become the action hero by the end of the movie. And it's not really spoiling anything to say that he doesn't, that's not what he becomes.
No.
Talk about that choice, because that clearly was intentional. You went against the grain on that.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it was interesting when we were looking at cowards in movies, they're very hard to find, you know. There's very few examples. You know, you can think of the guy in Miller's Crossing, he pleads for his life in a very sort of pitiful way. You can think of, I don't know if you remember the movie Gangster Number One, where Eddie Marson pleads for his life. He's really frightened and he, you know, has snot dripping out of his nose. But there weren't many examples of that. And I sort of feel a lot of people in real life, if they were confronted with their own death, right, you're going to be killed, they would, a lot of people would fall to pieces. I'm sure that's what happens in reality quite a lot. You know, they would just be overwhelmed by panic and fear and would probably lose the ability to do anything very much at all, you know. Whereas in a movie, we all know what happens because we've seen it 100 times. The hero literally steps to the plate. You know, they step close to the camera and the camera pushes in on them and they say a snappy one-liner, you know.
Yeah.
But I just don't think that's how it really happens in real life. And we thought it would be interesting, like, okay, let's do this for real. Let's show what it's like to be a coward, you know. And I guess that's what we're doing in the film, is we're exploring two different reactions to when your life's under threat. But I think what I'm really pleased about is we cast Douglas Booth, and Doug was willing, you know, ironically, it takes a very brave man to play a coward, you know. And he was willing to go there and to play it with no ego, you know. And when we came to shoot those scenes, the ones that I think you're thinking of, I was sort of half expecting him to say, could we just change it? You know, can we make it a little bit different? What if I threw a punch, and what if I strangle him for a bit and then he kicks my legs away? You know, all this kind of thing, which wasn't what was scripted. What was scripted is what we shot. And he absolutely didn't want to do that. He knew what he was in for and why he was there. And it was interesting, you know, there's a lot of men who have said to me, yeah, I get that bit, you know, they enjoy that bit. They sort of laugh at it because they're seeing themselves there, you know.
Yeah.
It's surprising how many people sort of take me aside and say that. I thought that was fun. I thought it was part of the fun of the film was to really go there. And, you know, it makes me laugh, that scene, but I've watched it with an audience and they don't seem to find it that funny.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Well, it comes across as real, and that's...
Yeah.
That's something that there's this tonal... There's this... couple gears that are taking place in the film where it is very real, traumatic home invasion, violence, and then gleeful monster movie. You use the word glee, and I love that because our creatures are gleeful. They clearly enjoy what they do.
Yeah.
Talk about that balance and how you were setting out to strike it without taking us out of one story or the other.
Yeah, well, obviously that tone is, you know, tricky, and I think you've encapsulated there. You've got two tones pulling in different directions, and I guess my job was to try and rein them in and not allow one tone to pull the other off. And so I guess, you know, it could almost, there's almost a horror comedy version of this film, which isn't the one we made. And the goblins, which I guess were trying to lead us that in that direction. And I suppose there's another version of the film which is quite grim and depressing and black and morbid, which maybe the characters were pulling a little bit in that direction, but again, didn't really want to go there either. So for me, it's meant to be entertaining and a sort of roller coaster ride, particularly, you know, with quite a long ascent, you know, there's quite a long build up. Before the drop, but when it drops, it's quite you know, it's thrilling. I think it's a bit scary and exciting. Yeah, does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, I think it does, because you're able to these could be two very different movies, but they connect very nicely. And we get to a place. And what I enjoyed about it is the tense moments where we're dealing with people being threatened and harmed by other people. You're so in that story that even though you know there are these monsters in this world on the periphery, you get lost enough in that story, in the home invasion story, that you think, well, this is it. This is where we are now. And the monsters aren't coming back.
Yeah.
And then they come back and it's enjoyable because yes, you are able to build up the human tension. And I don't like that kind of movie. Like that's the movie that it gets to me, but then the monsters come back and I'm like, okay, I'm back in this fun part. You know, it's like, I want to see bad guys harmed by the creatures, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. I suppose they bring the fun back, don't they, really?
Yeah.
And I guess the very beginning of the movie, like the very first, I don't know what it is, 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
You're in the real world, you know, because you haven't gone to Ireland yet. We're in London. And we're kind of finding the reason why they move in the first place and why they've got problems, you know. And that's the real world, yeah.
Well, this town that they go to,
yeah.
There was, in my mind, I thought of like Wicker Man, you know, you go to a town that has a secret. And I kind of wonder, we have the one character that knows about the Red Caps and accepts their existence. And then meanwhile, you have Colmini's family that they just, they're just bad guys. They're doing their thing. But is there more in this town to this story? Are there more people in this town, this little hamlet that are aware of these guys, of these Red Caps? Is there a deeper kind of thread that even in your mind you were building out with the other residents?
I suppose what we try and suggest at the beginning is that maybe you're going to go down that Wicker Man road a little bit, and you know, you're looking for what's happening, you know, what's really happening. And we're throwing hints and questions and all kinds of things, you know, out there, just to keep, you know, to keep it interesting. But we didn't really, you know, some people in the town believe, some people don't believe. What's an absolute given is that the lady who used to live in the house that Jamie and Maya move into, Maeve, went down every evening and put a little plate with a bit of raw liver on it into a pint-sized door, you know, at the foot of her garden. And that liver vanished, and then she'd go and collect the plate. I mean, she would do that every day, you know. She believed in the Red Caps, and I guess there's various people around the town who believe in them as well, and there's various people who don't, you know.
I want to talk a little bit about the creature effects as well, because I think when these are all practical effects, I'm guessing.
Well, it's yes, in a way. So it's a kind of marriage, really. It's a marriage of two techniques. Do you remember a film called Cat's Eye?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course.
The Stephen King adaptation.
Yeah.
Also, so that final...
Also involving a little goblin, right?
Right, exactly. And so I always remembered very fondly that final story with Drew Barrymore and that little guy. And basically you have an actor in a costume walking around in a massive set. So like, as I remember, he gets on a giant roller skate and things like that. And they just built this huge set. And there's something very pleasing about that, because you can see that it's real. And so what we did for this film is we built double height sets. So when that guy reaches up and opens the French door, he really is reaching up and opening a 12 foot high French door and stepping through it. And so we had people, stunt performers wearing masks, playing the goblins. But when you get into close-ups on the masks, we had an actor called Rick Warden, who's an old friend of mine, who was motion captured, and his performance is animated onto the masks. So it's kind of a marriage of CG and practical. But I think as a result, you get a sort of a best of both worlds where you can't really... You can see when their goblins are jumping around and interacting that they really are interacting with something.
Yeah.
But they are obviously small, you know, because they were short stunt performers anyway, and they were on double height sets. So,
The one of the reviews that I read mentioned reference like that they look like they came out of a Jim Henson workshop. Yeah. And I think, well, that's pretty high praise. And they do look like
Yeah, I think as a result of the techniques we use, people think that they're puppets. But I mean, they're pretty good puppets if they're puppets, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think you could get puppets to do that, have that range of facial expression. And one of the things I always felt about, you know, I'm obviously a child of the 80s and very influenced by, you know, the classic creature features from the 80s. But one thing that always pains me a bit when I look at them now is when you get into those close-ups, the face is always very inexpressive and they look a bit, you know, rubbery and a bit rubbish. But then what I don't like about, you know, there's some incredible CG effects, you know, incredible goblins nowadays, but I often feel when you are in the wides and they're fighting with each other or they're interacting with the main actors, they just look a bit off, you know, that the gravity doesn't look quite right somehow. They don't really look like they have correct weight and they bounce around with this sort of strange, like they look a bit like a video game. And so the approach we used, which was quite tricky because we had to use motion control cameras and replicate the moves, the camera moves on the big sets on the normal size sets. So it was technically quite challenging to do it this way, but I felt quite strongly in that we would get a really good result. And yeah, I'm really pleased with how the goblins look. I think they look really cool.
Yeah, no, they do. I like it. And it's,
you don't see lots of them. It's quite, they're sort of held back, but that's the nature of indie filmmaking. Unfortunately, we didn't have studio budget to spend. Otherwise, maybe you'd have a lot more goblins. But I think when you get to see them, they're really cool. You know,
I mean, I'm also a child of the 80s, but yeah. And it's a universal monster thing that it's when you don't see the shark, it's more terrifying. It builds the terror. So when you do see it, it's a solid payoff. I like that approach. I want to talk a little bit. We need to talk about the ending before I let you go, but I do want to talk about this cast because you have Hannah John Kamen plays Maya, and she's now basically on her way to being an action hero. She's in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah. You have American audiences will recognize Colm Meaney, you know, of course, from Star Trek, but also a great character actor that's been seen around a lot. And then these other Irish actors that are well known for TV and film over there. Talk about bringing this cast together and just them fitting so well together. Oh, and then of course Christian Narn from Game of Thrones. Talk about bringing this cast together.
Well, we had a wish list, you know, and I think really this is one of the advantages of shooting near the pandemic is a lot of people were available, so we just went for our wish list and we got them, you know. So I think we got a fabulous cast, and those Irish actors are pretty famous in the UK and Ireland, maybe not so well known in the US, from what I understand, but really, really great actors. And I think what I liked is they've all got, you know, a lot of them are known for comedy, and they brought a bit of a, you know, this isn't a comedy horror, but they brought a bit of fun. I mean, in the same way that the goblins have a kind of gleeful, mischievous enjoyment for doing wicked things, so do the Irish bad guys, you know. And they enjoy themselves as well, and I think they brought a lot of fun to it. And it's just a really good cast. I think Hannah is a brilliant actress; like she's a proper top drawer actress. And I think what I really liked about what she did is she kind of approached this. You know, there's probably a world in which she could have approached it as well. It's just a creature feature. It's a bit kind of glorified B movie, but she came at it like, you know, like she was doing something she might win an Oscar for. So she really, really lent into it and tried to make it real and tried to make it emotionally truthful. I think that's, for me, that's what makes it an interesting film, is I think you've got, you know, real performances. There's nothing spoofy about the movie, really. Mm-hmm. It's not pastiche or tongue-in-cheek or knowing. I think that makes it a bit easy for the audience in a way, you know. it's very, very easy in a way when it's like, oh, that's that film and that's that film and none of this is serious. And it's like, no, we kind of played it straight, even though, you know, the premise is pretty preposterous in a way.
Well, or is it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, there's parts of this world that remain, you know, fairly undiscovered. Who knows what's out there? But
yeah, exactly. And it's a metaphor, you know. It's really about psychology. It's sort of like a dream version of a psychological problem. Yeah.
Well, what does take place at the end? Because you're not the first
person to ask me that question.
I mean, we have this red sky, perhaps blood rain. We have she's baptized, I guess. How did you view it, and what happens next? What's the next frame after we see in credits?
Well, there was a scene that we wrote, and in the end we decided not to shoot it because we thought the ending was so powerful and sort of out there and extreme. Thought let's end it there and leave it on a high, if you like, but also with a question like, wow, what just happened then? But there was a little coda scene where Jamie is wearing a pinafore, you know, like a thing that you wear for cooking, an apron, and he's cooking dinner, and there's a ring at the doorbell, and he goes and answers the door, and there's three Irish sort of lads there who are, you know, not very nice guys, and he calls to Maya, and Maya comes and answers the door, and he goes back to cooking and looking after the baby. And then in the background you hear these fellows being torn to shreds and screaming for their lives, and Jamie says, "Mummy's just looking after. Mummy's with her little friends. She'll be back in a minute." You know. So that's what happens next. But also there's a sequel where Daddy Whelan's brother comes over from the States. His American brother, Donnie Whelan. And if Donnie Whelan can prove that Daddy Whelan's been murdered, he stands to inherit all the money that he's got in the building company. So it's about, And I don't know if you're familiar with the legend of the Fomorians, who are the Irish sea giants.
I've heard of them, but go on, please.
Well, they're part of the sequel as well, you know, so that it's little people and giants.
Well,
and angry Americans.
So I guess that's the question I was also going to ask is like, is this a world that you want to revisit and keep expanding?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. Yeah. I mean, the only issue is we built that house, you know, the interior of that house is a massive set. I mean, a huge set, and we destroyed it, as you can tell in the film. We destroyed it. So that would have to be rebuilt. So, I mean, that's the only fly in the ointment. Is that would be a major undertaking to rebuild that house. But that aside, I'd love to revisit it. Yeah. I mean, I've read a lot of times now, the film's come out in England, as you know, and a lot of the comments are, this is a cult movie in the making. This is a cult movie, you know, and I definitely set out to make it in the most extreme way I could, you know, without kind of any compromise. And I don't mean in the sense of compromise, like we obviously were on an indie budget, and so we're not making a big movie, we're making a small movie, although I think an entertaining movie. But there were no tonal or there were no real compromises at all made, you know. And so like that ending that you mentioned, I was delighted with how out there that ending was. And I really, you know, I've shot a lot of mainstream television, and, you know, on a television set, I would be getting a tug on my elbow, and they'd be saying, "What are you doing? You know, what the hell is going on here? You know, you can't do it like this." And there was no tug on the elbow. You know, in fact, everybody on the finance side, I'm very grateful for this, because I'm sure a lot of the people you talk to, whether they say it or not, don't have this experience, you know, where they're allowed to do whatever they want. But I really was. And so I just thought, well, you know, if we're going to do it, let's just make it, let's just go out, let's push it out there. And let's try and make this as singular a kind of viewpoint as it is. And I think that's what makes a cult movie, isn't it, really? And I sort of felt like I personally was getting a bit bored of the big films, you know. They felt quite formulaic, and you could kind of see the ending coming, and you sort of think, well, I know what's going to happen. It's either going to be this or this, A or B, and then it's B, and you think, yeah, there you go. And I wanted to make a film where the ending, I hope, feels satisfying, and it feels correct, and it makes sense, but also it's not predictable. Like, you couldn't see that exact ending coming, I don't think.
No, and that is what's enjoyable, because out of the many things, I mean,
yeah,
is this sort of WTF ending where, like, yeah, did not expect that swing, yeah, did not expect that one. And yeah, and I say that as a compliment, because yeah,
thank you,
you're taken on this journey and then you get into a very weird place.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so bizarre how we did it. Yeah. It made me laugh. I mean, I've got to be honest, when I was making it, when we put the goblins in, I just laughed and laughed and laughed. I think it's, to me, it's really funny, but I realized my sense of humor is, you know, I learned this early on when I was sitting in Blue Velvet watching Dennis Hopper's performance, and I thought it was really funny, his performance. And I realized when I was sitting in the cinema that other people did not find it funny at all, you know. And it's probably got less funny over time, that one. So, you know, it's sort of, what would you call that? Black humor, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do think there's that audience for it that gets it, that's yeah, along for the ride, you know? And I think that's why something like Wicker Man continues to yeah, hold up. It's like, you can go into these strange places and still, and I would even argue like Midsommar has like very funny moments, and yeah, then very dark moments, and the audience is there for it. And I think it's probably also because, to your point, not compromising, you were able to tell the story that you set out to tell.
And I have to say, Ari Aster's been a bit of an influence, actually, because the ending of Hereditary was exactly what I'm talking about, where with the treehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And as that character enters the treehouse, I just thought, what? I mean, there's no way of predicting that ending ever, ever, ever. It was so off the wall. And I really enjoyed that. And I thought, okay, well, this is interesting, because this isn't formulaic at all. This is the opposite of formula. This is, you know, the language of a kind of crazy dream. So, yeah. And again, Midsommar, you've got that fantastic shot of Florence Pugh towards the end, which is kind of what the whole movie has been building towards.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely was inspired by those two films. And I thought, and also a whole bunch of the other kind of modern, the more recent horrors, where they're quite thought provoking. And it really made me want to make another horror movie. I thought, I really like these new type of horrors, where they are horror movies, and they are in the genre, and they do deliver blood and guts and all those things, you know, scares and transgression and all the stuff we've come to expect, but they're also about something. They make you think, you know. And a lot of the things I've read about the movie, I feel like some people really get it and some people don't understand it. And it does feel, I think, like one of those films, it's going to take a little while to kind of, for people to get used to it, and then they'll go, oh, I get it now. I understand what the point of view is, because I think the point of view is extremely singular. And the actors all supported that, you know. In fact, everybody, the production designer, the cameraman, everybody supported, got behind that singular point of view. So I guess that gives you a cult movie in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I know we're out of time, but I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you, and I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. Too. It was a good ride, and, you know, made me, stressed me out, and then, you know, yeah, and then delivered the the violent mischief that I love. So it was hitting me on two different cylinders there. So
exactly.
John, thank you so much for your time, my friend. Thank you.
Excellent. That was a good chat. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Once again, that was director John Wright, whose new movie, Unwelcome, is available now on digital in the UK and is coming to select theaters in the US on March 10th and then available on digital in the US on March 14th. And this has been Talking Strange. If you have a story you'd like to share of the strange and the unusual, email us at talkingstrange@denageek.com. And until next time, I'm Aaron Sagers. And I'll actually always be Aaron Sagers even after next time. But until next time, be kind, stay spooky, and keep it weird.
Talking Strange is a part of the Den of Geek Network, available wherever you listen to other podcasts. If you like what we're doing, share Talking Strange with your friends and fellow spooky nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and leave a nice review. If you have a strange or paranormal story you would like to share with us, please email talkingstrange@denofgeek.com for a chance to have it read on a future episode. For video episodes of Talking Strange, check out twitch.tv/denofgeektv and youtube.com/denofgeekus. And please follow @talkstrangepod on Twitter and @AaronSagers on Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon for more paranormal pop culture content.